Well, I mean, I want today to do some leftovers. I mean, topics that we didn't touch in during the previous meetings. Now, there is one question that I didn't ask you about your childhood and the days you were a student. And that's, what was your attitude toward sciences? I mean, biology or mathematics or physics?
When I was at school.
At school?
I didn't know anything before that.
Yes.
My attitude to biology, mathematics and physics was zero. It didn't exist. I was made to do a certain amount of science, so-called at school, chemistry, heat, what is it called? Heat, light, and some sound, is what it was called.
Yes.
And I was very bored by it. I was not much good at chemistry, and I was terribly bad at mathematics. I mean, I used to get myself and get scraped through, but with great difficulty. It was very badly taught. It was very boring. The only person who ever helped me was my Aunt Ida, who was a mathematician by training, curiously enough, who taught me how to prove propositions in Euclid. But unlike Einstein, who was sent off his entire career by a total fascination with Euclid, that's what excited him. And so when he read Euclid, he suddenly became totally transformed. When the same thing happened with Hobbes, who read a theorem of Euclid, it's in the end some kind of conclusion, said, by God, this cannot be true. And then he traced it to its premises and realized it was, and that gave him the idea of deductive method. But anyway, unlike these two great thinkers, Euclid did not make favorable impression on me. So really, I had nothing to do with it.
Did you develop any kind of resentment or barriers?
No. Not at all.
And when you came to Oxford?
I had perfect respect for science. I had no sense of an enemy subject. No.
No, that's surely. But
most people have it about philosophy. Yeah. We see what historians regard philosophy with real hostility. No, I didn't look. I thought these subjects were not, to me, of great interest. But they were something I knew, I didn't understand. Just like economics. I did an examination in economics. I did PPE, in philosophy, politics, and economics, in 1932. I never understood a single word. I read easy books. Henderson on supply and demand. Robertson on money. It's a well-known. Well, of course, I understood the sentences, but in the examination, I simply reproduced sentences I learned by heart in the hope that the examiners would understand them. I certainly didn't. I read an economics paper in All Souls, which was pure rubbish.
when you wrote Marx, you didn't feel that...
Well, I felt the economics was rather difficult for me.
It was?
Yes, I read Das Kapital. I couldn't have done it without.
Yeah.
But I mean, I didn't know if the economics was sound or unsound.
And when you wrote Marx and you came to...
I simply expounded the notion of surplus value and the things which are Marxist in Marx. Yeah. So without enlarging on Marx's economics, it's much the weakest part of the book.
Yes. And now, did you discuss it with friends? I mean, economists?
No. I was much too frightened of what they would say. Nobody in Oxford took interest in Marx. You see, he was a set book. In PP, you had to read it. You had to read Adam Smith, Ricardo, and Marx. Adam Smith, I could understand easily. Ricardo bored me terribly, but I could understand it. Marx, I never really got into. And there was certainly no Cole, I suppose, was a Marxist, but I didn't know him. There was nobody much I could talk to.
Who was the economist then in Oxford?
The professor of economics the man called McGregor, who is a very old-fashioned Cambridge Marshal. I don't think he's ever line of Marx. Took no interest. The Marxist people read Marx. Well, my tutor Lindley Fraser, who was a very, very bad tutor indeed, at Queen's, who taught me nothing, he certainly knew what Marx had said. Roy Harrod knew something about Marx. I remember a lecture by him. He believed in Marx's labor theory of value, funnily enough. But I remember a lecture in Christchurch on Marx. We all delivered lectures on Marx somewhere in the 30s, including books I was writing about it, some aspect of Marx. His was, of course, about economics. He said Marx is brilliant, man of brilliant intelligence, but, as he said, 50 years in the British Museum handled that once excellent intellect and filled it with mud. After that, I didn't feel a necessity.
Now, your friends in Oxford, who were Marxists or communists in the 30s, it was very fashionable, let's say, in the continent, or even in Palestine, for Marxists to try to study Marxist economy. I mean, not in school, not in university.
No, of course.
Did they try? I mean, your friends.
I know of nobody who did.
No.
Well, who am I, socialist or Marxist? I'll tell you. Christopher Hill.
He
was here in 1934. He was elected to All Souls.
Yes.
In 1934, and I made friends with him. I don't think he knew a thing about Marxist economy. Mm-hmm. What he should have done, no doubt he knew the doctrines. He was interested in exploitation, class struggle. But the minutiae, Marx economics, were very strongly doubted. Certainly never in conversation mentioned it. I'm sure that my friend Guy Burgess, certainly Marx, who I never knew to be Marxist, knew nothing about it and cared less. Who else were communists in Oxford whom I knew? Philip Toynbee. Not no economics at all.
And socialists? Or let's say people like...
Stuart Hampshire, nothing.
Nothing. Or Jennifer. Or, you see, in my days, when we were young, it was very fashionable to study political economy because of...
No, Marx, of course. Because of Marx.
So it was less here.
No, in fact, Marx here was a political sociological writer. I'm trying to think, I may be wrong. Kohl was certainly a kind of economist. He certainly was. He wrote a book about that. And there were people in the Labour Party here, who, in Ruskin. I'm sure you'd find people. But if you ask about people I knew, what communists did I know? There weren't that many for me to know. Among Dons, I didn't know a single Oxford Don to be a communist. Christville was. They didn't know it.
No, but not the members. People who had some inclinations thought communists.
No, I understand.
You had more.
No fellow travellers, no.
No,
I'm just trying to who were the socialists. There was a thing called the Pink Lunch. The Pink Lunch was a luncheon club founded by Kohl. We used to go to some cheap sort of pub, I mean the Wheat Sheaf or one of these places where we had bread and cheese. Those who wanted to drink beer. The people who went were the following. Let us take typical year 1936-37. The people around the table. Crossman. Gordon Walker. Pakenham, now Lord Longford. Stuart Hampshire, just elected All Souls. Austin. Roy Harrod. James Mead, who then got a Nobel Prize later, professor in Cambridge. H.M. Jones. The Roman historian, who was certainly a Marxist of sorts. He was All Souls, but in other words, his wife was even more Marxist than he was, but I hardly knew her. Richard Pears. This is the Labour Party. Rael Rouse. Then, of course, was a Rouse in those days. Now, who else were people there, and people I didn't know, and people from Ruskin came, who I just didn't know, and maybe there were other dons. They're all dons, you see, and there were a few I didn't know at all.
No lady?
None that I don't know of. We see Geneva, for example, was in London, she was the don. Herbert wasn't here. Who could have been? The female dons, no, there were no socialists, I would say, among the female dons of Oxford in the 30s. There were in the 40s and 50s. But not in the 30s, no. I'm just trying to think who they could have been. There was Beryl Smalley. She may have been a Marxist. She knew about, she was a medieval historian. She certainly was one. I don't think she came to our lunch, but she may have done. If she was, if Cole knew them, he would invite them.
I mean, the pink lunch was of fellows, not only...
Dons.
Dons.
They didn't do fellows.
Yes, yes.
But dons.
No
undergraduates. No graduates. No outsiders. And we used to have people come from London. It wasn't a free discussion. A Dalton would come. Or Busfield would come. Or German communists would escape. I mean, German Jewish communists would certainly come.
Or socialists.
Or socialists would go away from Hitler. I mean, typical German leftists would be invited.
That was between 35
and 39, perhaps.
I mean,
it went on after the war.
In the heyday.
It went on after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I went a bit. And gradually, I think it disappeared.
Coming back to the science, I mean, we are still in the sciences. In the Oxford days, what was your attitude towards...
Well, I want to explain. The pink lunch consisted of people who, in principle, were prepared to pack parcels for Spain, for the Spanish Republic. That was the criteria.
I would have thought so. Yes.
This is enough. I don't think Roy Harrod did or would have done, but
yes.
Still, the point was he was a liberal then. If you were a liberal and anybody who was anti-Chamberlain, anti-Baldwin, anti-conservative, anti the ruling class for that period was probably welcome. So Roy Harrod would have been, and Mead would have been, not exactly the right way. Yes, they were kind of right wing of it.
Now, of course, except conservative anti-appeasers or conservative...
No, they didn't.
They wouldn't come.
They didn't. They weren't with you.
Yeah.
Who were the conservative anti-appeasers?
I'm sure they were.
Among dons?
I'm sure.
Well, maybe, yes. I mean, not very many dons were deeply political. Of course, there must have been.
I mean, they were cast from the same mold as the conservative politicians were
anti-appeasers. No, you might think. All I can tell you is when Macmillan and who else came to talk against the famous election of 1938, which was post-Munich, which was an election entirely fought on Munich. It was a by-election. And the radio is going to do something about it, I think, next week. We have a program on it.
No,
might look, yes.
Ah.
Yes. I think, was it called Channel 4?
Yes,
Channel 4. Because I also was interviewed about it. I was about, now. Who were the dons who voted against Hogg? Unknown to have done. Maybe lots and lots, right? But of course one didn't know. Austin did, certainly, he was not a conservative. Went to Russia and rather liked it. Wait a moment. You see, there was Heath, who was president of the Union, I think, who was certainly pro Lindsay. Lindsay was right. There was Macmillan, okay. Maybe other Tory MPs. All the anti-appeasers.
There was a group.
Certainly. I don't know which one came, but to speak, but Macmillan was Oxford man, so he definitely came to speak. I don't know that I know of any. I didn't know who the conservative dons were. But I would guess the dons who identified themselves as conservatives. You see, the Cecil family were anti-Munich to a man. David Cecil certainly was. So you can't say that. You see? But they didn't take part in all this. And did I know conservatives? They would not have come to Pink Lunch, no. That's how it began. No, those sort of people, no. No, no, they were regarded as conservatives, maybe anti-Hitler, that wasn't enough.
Now, let's come back.
No, they had to have some degree of social concern. Certainly. That are you exactly.
And
Liblab.
And Harold Head.
Who?
Roy Harold.
Evidently. Evidently. Certainly, he was certainly socially concerned. In a very eccentric way.
And Freddie Eyre?
Yes, he came.
He would come.
Yes, he would pass.
And Stuart would come.
Stuart Cohen both would come. Certainly. Freddie Eyre certainly did come. He describes it, I think.
Now,
his autobiography.
In the warden of New College?
Yes.
Would he?
Oh, no, no. Pompous old, he may have been a liberal technically, but he belonged, and Asquith wouldn't have come. I mean, he was dead, but still, none of those people would come. Herbert Samuel would not have come.
Now, let's say, a man like Bill Deakin, who was a conservative, surely.
Wouldn't have come.
An anti-appeaser.
Wouldn't have come.
But he was anti-appeaser.
No, that makes no difference.
Yes, that's what I thought.
This was left of center.
That's it.
Never mind about appeasement.
And James Joel?
James Joel was not here, was an undergraduate.
Hudson did come.
Hudson did come. You're quite right. Now that you remind me, Hudson did come. It's exactly who came. Exactly right. Hudson was the exact flavor.
Now,
he'd make marvelously cynical, sardonic speeches in a slow voice. He would point out that everything that the League of Nations had said, everything which the Labour Party had said, turned out to be entirely untrue. He was pro-Zionist then. Hudson. Rare thing to be. Then. He thought it was in the interest of the British Empire to back Zionism.
Which means he supported the British Empire.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. No, no, no. He was a member of the Labour Party. But he was a patriot. And to that extent, something could be made of the Empire.
No, I mean, patriot, yes, but
imperialist. I mean, no, he wasn't an imperialist, but he was not anti-imperialist. He wasn't sure which way it would go, but he thought England had a good deal of good to do to these people.
Now, if A.J.P. Taylor would come to such a meeting?
Now, was he here? He was here. I don't remember him there. I know, no, he came and he was here, but by the time of the war, he was maudlin. Yes, but he came here about 2-3 years before the war he was here. Well, he may have been there. I just don't happen to remember. I think it would be surprising if he didn't. Very surprising if he didn't. It's exactly the kind of person who would have come. If he didn't, it's because he was bored, isn't it?
And it was Cole who was the prime mover.
Cole created it, yes. Cole was more or less the chairman.
No, but that was a digression from... I mean, I was asking you about scientists. Now, when you were here as a student and then a graduate, I mean, did you take interest in scientific innovations and discoveries?
No. I read books about the philosophy of science because I took a certain interest in the relation, in the logic of science or what philosophers thought about science that I couldn't avoid doing. And I took some interest in what was the meaning of certain types of scientific statement. I wasn't much good at it. But that, of course, did occupy all the empirical philosophers automatically, because science was the center of interest in it. But actual science, physics, chemistry, biology, I don't think I read a single, even popular book about that.
Would you try to ask a friend to explain what was the quantum theory?
No. I should have done maybe, but I didn't.
No.
I'm telling you, no. And I don't know who the friend would be.
Oh, now I come to the question.
I don't think I knew any.
I mean, did you have friends?
Among scientists? That's a very good question. And I was trying to answer it, yes. I obviously must have done. were English scientists. At all cells, there were none. There were none in my entourage. You see, right. Now then. I sat next to scientists in New College, where I dined once or twice a week. Mathematician scientists, but I don't think I asked them any questions about science. No. Certainly I knew scientists. Great friends? No. I don't think I had an intimate friend. I don't think I had a real friend among scientists. I knew some of the German scientists were refugees, for example. Szilard used to come and see me because it was extremely amusing.
Szilard was Hungarian.
Szilard was Hungarian, yes. Via Germany. Yes. Szilard came through Oxford. And Szilard was a man without whom there would have been no atom bomb. That's very clear. From every point of view. Both the scientific understanding of what was going on and work at it. And from the point of view of getting Einstein to write the famous letter to Roosevelt. And otherwise nothing would have happened at all. But anyway, Szilard, Leo Szilard, because he was entertaining, I knew one or two of the German Jewish refugees, certainly. Scientists.
Hans Krebs.
Well, I knew Solly Zuckerman was a scientist. But he didn't talk to me about apes, monkeys. Not to anybody else either.
Nobody was a real friend. You didn't have a real friend among the scientists.
No.
Not a curious.
And I don't think I ever did. In after years either. No, I don't think it is curious. I don't think it is curious. I think, it's true there are no two cultures. CP's note talks nonsense about that, in my opinion. But, number of scientists who took the interest in ideas or in moral questions or in politics of a sophisticated kind, well, more or less intelligent kind, were not known to me. Jack Haldane, I suppose, such Robert, he was at Cambridge. Julian Huxley, you could say, well, he was a friend, but not a great friend. He was a friend, yes.
No, I mean, you make friends with a scientist if you made friends with him in young age and you kept him.
Yeah, but this didn't happen. This didn't happen. Of course.
At school.
There were scientists at school, but I never knew them.
Yeah. And doctor?
Doctor, I must have known. What physicians, yes. Not in Oxford, certainly. Nobody in the medical faculty, except for Zuckerman, who had once been a friend.
And later in life?
No. Apart from the doctors who looked after me, yes. Professionally.
Yes.
I'm trying to think, yes, I mean, all right, I had a friend who was a doctor, who was a Zionist, was a man called Shire, Shire. His father was one of the early English Zionists. And his name was Hugh Shire. His real name was Herzl Shire, which is a typical name for a father, like Theodor Gerster.
Yes, yes.
All that comes from Herzl. You see, well, he was a friend, yes. But,
Your age, it's not that he treated you or...
Oh, no. Not professionally. He was a friend, not a great friend,
yes.
But somebody I knew. He was at Oxford and I saw him a little bit afterwards and so on. But I'm trying to think if I had genuine friends among doctors. No. So I think now, I may remember something later. For the moment, I can't think of anybody. a young man called Lowbury, who is a jury doctor, who sends me his poetry, occasionally even now. Well, I must have known, but not known well.
Now, in Israel, Sambursky is a scientist, but it is a philosopher of science, an historian of science.
He was once a street scientist.
No, but the part of in him that interests you...
Of course, it's the other.
Yeah, sure.
No, I've never been a great scientist or a talented scientist. We are not. Cambridge is different. Cambridge is different. I'm trying to think of who I could have known and blame myself for not knowing. I'm trying to, who were the eminent scientists of Oxford before the war? There must have been such. I think they kept themselves to themselves, yes. I don't think they mingled with the rest of Oxford. They felt pariahs, rather. They felt isolated. Inchelwood was a scientist who knew Russian and Latin, was all kinds of interesting, very cultivated. I met him, but he was not a very nice man. Brilliant, and got a Nobel Prize, but I never would have been a friend of his.
You never discussed it with Weizmann, or not, Weizmann never discussed it with...
No, never. Well, the only thing he ever said of interest about science was that it was morally very purifying. And therefore, when he was in terrible disgusted with Zionist intrigues and depressed, disgusted, and in some way terribly low, sort of low-spirited, you'd go to the laboratory, that would help. That's all, but I mean, he used to talk about cracking oil to produce rubber, I mean, which was a speciality in the war, but I never knew what it meant. And I knew Bergman, of course.
Yes, I know. You don't like sociologists.
No. Well, I mean, personally, no. Some of my best friends are.
That's the question. Now, you don't like sociology, I can see, and I have my sympathy and empathy.
No, it's true.
But...
I can't... at least I don't think. I've never yet... I mean, the point about sociology, it should be a very important, interesting subject. My only case against sociology is that it's a failure. As a field of knowledge. Nothing wrong with it. In principle, I don't say that it couldn't become wonderful.
Yeah.
It might. There's no reason why sociology shouldn't become a brilliant success. If I read the great 19th century sociologists, I gain a great deal from them, because the ideas are very interesting. Max Weber, Durkheim, Karl Marx, even a few others in the 20th century. I suppose people like Lévi-Bruhl, you see, but that's just like reading, you see, all these people did something before they became sociologists. I mean, Marx was a lawyer, Durkheim was a philosopher, and Weber was a historian. So, when they write, I become interested, the ideas seem interesting to me, as one would be, if one read a very, very gifted publicist, essayist. I just didn't feel there was something scientific or something which, to me, science was, I have a very narrow view of science. My narrow view is that nothing is a science unless there are general propositions which have a great deal of evidence for them and not much evidence against them, and from which it is possible to predict. That I did not find in sociology. So, if you don't call it a science, I have less against it.
Yeah.
There can be insights. There have been. I mean, who should deny that Karl Marx or Max Weber had very remarkable insights? And therefore, my view about sociology is this. It's a subject which, added to other subjects, does good. Sociological approach to history, to geography, to anthropology, to anything else. It's like salt or mustard. But in its pure state, it's indigestible. And they know it, half know it, and that's why the gobbledygook, the appalling obscurity, and the phraseology, is a desperate attempt to make themselves feel like scientists. But the ones who are intelligent and honest among them, in a sense, they don't believe it themselves. Too late to change. Mrs. Flood, my friend, was accused by Halsey in Nuffield, who is a very simple soul, you see, of betraying the subject, undermined by Hart and Plamenitz, was a great friend. I don't think that Schills, whom I don't deeply respect, very believes in it either. He writes essays, to his interest in learning. Raymond Aron was a professor of sociology. He thought was such a subject, obviously. But nothing in his writings seems to me to be strictly sociological in character. He's just a highly intelligent man writing very interesting things. But I think without benefit, sociology would be exactly the same. That's my point. You see?
But that means, of course, that sociologists who really adhere to their opinion that it is a science.
Social thought is a real thing. The history of social thought is a perfectly genuine subject. Analysis of society, I mean, thoughts about the nature of past and contemporary societies is a perfectly good historical subject, which may need a certain injection of psychology, but that's all it is. If sociologists only call themselves contemporary history or history with a social slant, social history is absolutely authentic. Nothing wrong with it. History of social ideas, quite all right. Social ideas themselves, quite all right.
Yes. Now, but I had the feeling that you have become suspicious and critical almost automatically of sociologists who define themselves as sociologists in the way that you don't like. I mean,
yes.
Scientists.
People who believe that they're pursuing a science.
And I think you criticize them. It's sometimes much more strongly than you would criticize others. People who did it with other fields.
Because social anthropology is a genuine subject. If you go to the Trobriand Islands or Java and try and describe what the dances of the Javanese mean to them, in what sense they're bound up with some kind of outlook, what the inner life, that I understand. I don't believe it can be done by applying questionnaires, which is what sociologists appear to believe in. I think that's done partly intuitively, by living among them, by learning their language, by identifying in some way, by, as it were, ordinary, so to speak, means of sensibility to the society in which we live, which any, so to speak, gifted observer could achieve. Sociologists don't do that. You see, they believe in some kind of formulation of hypotheses, which they then try and prove. The proofs are too weak, but I'll tell you something much worse about sociology, which will explain my distaste for it. Let me make a strongly paradoxical proposition, which has exceptions. No doubt. I don't believe that, let us say, since the end of the First World War, any sociologist has made a sociological proposition, I don't mean general ideas, but has made a formulation, sociological generalization or hypothesis, which is worth examining. Either it's common sense, wrapped up in language, so to speak, complicated, so to speak, in unnecessarily complicated language, or either that, or it is total, just formula, just simply what the French call cliquetis de formule, just the clicking of formulae, one after the other. I mean, someone like Danny Bell, who is a perfectly intelligent man, writes quite good books on, I don't know, American society, Western Industrial society. There's nothing wrong with it, but I don't think this is done by applying scientific models.
Now, it's mainly the new American sociology that is really distasteful. I mean, in the continent, we didn't have...
Well, because I didn't read it very much. I mean, who are the others?
I mean, the others are more...
Mannheim, the sociologist, of some importance. He did have some interesting ideas. No, I wouldn't deny that. Semi-Marxist, semi-Frankfurt sociologist, who hadn't really disagreed with him, but he had something to say. I mean, the idea of, I didn't know it's a sociological idea, even the idea of, what is it, of sociology of knowledge, which is the thing, you see, is simply the proposition that knowledge, the state of knowledge, or the state of people who assert that they know, depends very largely on the influence, social influences, which influence them, yes? I think it's an idea.
And Ortega y Gasset?
That I thought was, when I tried to read it, I thought that was absolutely awful.
Journalism or...?
No, reactionary nonsense. Reactionary nonsense. It's against hatred of mobs, French Revolution, liberalism, socialism. It's just a piece of, rather like Oakeshott. It's just extreme reaction against modernism of every kind. You could just as well say Toynbee. We're exactly the same. We just say T.S. Eliot. But we've gotten into trouble with the room.
I'm going to ask you.
Certainly. Certainly.
The I light. Just asked you before. Maybe, I mean, you had a
why not?
Yes, I was. I
mean, I'll tell you. There's nothing much to tell. But yes, I have something to say.
If you want, let's say, discuss it now.
Why not? It's quite amusing. Yeah. Sorry, I'll just look at the watch. Yes, yes. I have 20 minutes at least. Let me explain.
So now we come back to Eliot.
Let me go back a little bit.
Yes, I would like
he sent me these books for review. And I reviewed them. I was quite pleased to be approached by the Criterion, which I regarded as a very distinguished periodical. It was clear. It was very reactionary in some ways, because people like Maurras, who was a French Luxembourg Française man, and other people wrote for it. And there's no doubt that Eliot had what he said about himself. In politics, I'm a monarchist. In religion, I'm a, whatever it is, Anglo-Catholic. In art or literature, I'm a classicist. But saying monarchist was, in England was enough. It didn't mean much. In English terms, after all, the number of anti-monarchists was not very great. But in French terms, it certainly meant something. That's what he meant. So there was no doubt about his political views. Nobody thought that it was a liberal at any time. But anyway, the first letter I ever wrote to him, I wrote when I was an undergraduate, when I sent him a copy of the Oxford Outlook, which is a highbrow periodical which I was the editor. He replied very nicely saying, thank you very much for sending me. I like keeping an eye on these undergraduate periodicals because there's something else and to send it to me. Something like that. Then I met him. Yeah. In Oxford. He came to talk to an undergraduate society called the Florentine Club, which consisted of Hedonist Stuart Hampshire's friends. And he delivered a lecture to the university, a very gloomy lecture. He read his poetry. Then afterwards he was given supper, you see, by these undergraduates. And he and I had a very agreeable and long conversation about what is translatable and what is not. And he particularly took interest in Wilhelm Busch, the German writer of children's rhymes. Comic verse. Nobody else in the room knew anything about him. Only he and I did. So we had a dialogue which lasted about half an hour while everyone else was terribly frustrated, which we both enjoyed very much. And so my relations with him were quite friendly, and I was quite pleased. I greatly admired him. I had read his prose essays. I didn't agree, but he's what's called a genuinely eminent critic. Well, that is no doubt. Interesting critic. Now, then, at some point after the war, I think, maybe even during the war, I read this famous essay by him called, a book called After Strange Gods. After Strange Gods is a book delivered as lectures to the University of Virginia, in the course of which he congratulates Virginians on being, so to speak, mono-ethnic, of being not mixed with a very good Anglo-Saxon, so to speak, Anglicans, more or less, of Anglo-Saxon origin, in the course of which he says something, I can't remember the exact sentence, famous sentence, notorious sentence, in which he says, no society can flourish, speaking in this sense, if it has in it too many free-thinking Jews. Now, he was attacked on it by other people. You see, but I simply read it as a sentence and wondered, this is about 35, in the middle of Hitler, before the Holocaust. Nevertheless, Hitler was going. So it wasn't. He never reprinted that book. It was never republished. That was, in effect, because I think he knew that this caused complaints by Jewish liberals and others. Very good. Now, in 1951, I wrote a piece for the Hebrew University, which was called Jewish Liberty, Jewish Freedom and Emancipation. In the course of the second part of that, I never had that reprinted, because I thought the Jews would hate it too much. At the time, I remember Keith Joseph saying, you say the Jews are like hunchbacks. You can say that. You can say that, but write it. Oh, for you. Perfect. Quite all right. I know you. I didn't think you would disagree. Right. Now, in the course of which I said, yes, Jews can be very tiresome, difficult, they can be trouble-giving, but no liberal society has a right to remove them or persecute them for that reason. Ordinary liberal sentiment. But pluralism. There are only three writers who want to have a completely uniform society. They're not the only ones I can think of. Are Plato, Eliot, and Köstler. Now, I didn't... Eliot because of this sentence. Yes. Köstler because...
It was a reply to Köstler. Your article was a reply to Köstler?
No, no. I had a correspondence with Köstler about that, but this right, the article itself wasn't. I think his thing came afterwards. He wrote a very amusing article in which he said, no, at the time of 51 he was a revisionist.
No, he wrote this article when he said, after the state was born, I'm free to choose.
Oh, I'm free. Yeah.
And I thought the article was, you referred in the article, anyway.
I certainly did. I don't know whether I referred to the article. Oh, maybe a footnote. But what the minister was about it. What he said was very entertaining. What he said was, 3 times a day Jews pray to be returned unto Zion. For $372, they get TWA plane. Go there. In the autumn, they pray for rain. Outside it's raining cats and dogs because some obscure agricultural people happen to need rain at that season. This must stop. Jews must stop driving the rest of the world mad. Either they go to Israel or they intermarry. Stop being a nuisance. That was the point of the article. So I naturally put Kessler there. For that reason. Because I said they were right to be a nuisance. That was the point of the disagreement. I replied to him at length. Oh, yes. In an article.
And you said that there was room for Zionism even after the state was formed.
Yeah, no. What kind of thing? Well, that wasn't, I think, part of this. At least I don't think so. I may be wrong. Some busybody sent Eliot, probably the Jewish Chronicle issue in which this was reprinted. I was at Bryn Mawr in America, in Pennsylvania, lecturing in the spring of 52. Is what we're talking about, I received a letter of Eliot in which he was very, very extremely courteous. He said he hoped I enjoyed his drawing Bryn Mawr. He'd been there himself. He hoped I... what happened to the bronze bed which the founder, Miss Thomas, had presented from India? Did I have to sleep in it as he did? The central heating system was apt to make one first very hot and then very cold. Did I suffer from it? A lot of perfectly polite chit-chat. He then came to the point and said, I think you've got me wrong. I can't remember exactly what he said. It all appeared in Mrs. Eliot's edition of his letters. So you see. But he said, look, I'm not against the Jews in any way. More or less, I'm not Semitic. I mean, the point is, my attitude towards Jews is entirely religious. That was the thesis. All I have against them is they did not become converted in, let us say, the year 30 AD or something like that. That's all I have against them. I'm simply opposed to them on religious grounds as a religion. I'm not an anthropologist. I have nothing to do. I don't think of them as a community or as a race or as a nation. This is all beside the point. The only thing I think about them in terms of is their religion. To which I replied, and other things like it. I replied, and I didn't know why he bothered to write to me. That's because we were in some way friends. He respected me. His widow says that he had a high opinion of me, so much better. He then replied, and I replied, and I said, this couldn't be quite right. I fully accepted what he said, and of course I didn't think it was an anti-Semite, all kinds of polite things. I don't think I'd read about the Jews even then. But as I said that you talk about free-thinking Jews, you can't say free-thinking Baptists, and you can't say free-thinking Catholics, free-thinking Negroes, perhaps yes. So you must be thinking about Jews something other than simply a community of believers. Maybe I said other things, I don't know. He then replied to that and said, well, you know, I mean, I'm not an anthropologist. I have nothing against Jews going to Palestine. I don't think they can all get in. So I think it's not a final solution. The problem is on and so on. Anyway, another day, when we both have time, you and I must continue this interesting correspondence, after which our relations became distinctly cooler. There's no quarrel, but I somehow felt a sudden flutter occurred, and he made one. He wrote me a fan postcard about the lecture which I delivered on Rousseau. He did. He said it was marvelous, wonderful, and he agreed with it, and he thought very well of it.
He was present, or did he...
No, it was a wireless. Nobody was present. It was entirely done on radio. It was called Freedom is Betrayal.
Yes.
And one of the lectures about Rousseau, and he found that what I said about that was absolutely excellent. And so a fan postcard reached me. And very, very complimentary. Then he published something for the Conservative Center, in which he talked about, referred to me again, more ironically. I can't, something about the, something like the cataract of Mr. Berlin's words, or something like that, or the, something rather like that, the flow, the unceasing flow, something like that. It's not entirely polite. It was hostile, but not a little bit ironical. And that was it. I didn't think I met him again. If I had done it, we would have been, we would have talked, chatted quite politely, I'm sure. Yes, I think I did. I met him in the train.